Okay, thank you very much, Yanni, and thank you very much for this wonderful invitation. We'll switch topic a bit from what we were discussing before. I will try to address the topic of gamification in a kind of an arbitrary manner of mine. Past years I was reading quite a lot of Paolo Virno, a political philosophy from Italy. And reading it, I realized that there are some points in what they're talking about regarding labor nowadays that help us understand a lot the networks. So what Virno addresses here, as you can read, he says, if the entirety of post-Fordist labor is productive of surplus value labor, precisely because it functions in a political virtuosic manner, then the question to ask is this: what is the score which the virtuoso's worker perform, and what is the script that their linguistic communicative performance is? I don't want to tire you, so I'll try to simplify my thought based on Virno's writing. So virtuosity is a very basic notion for Virno. And the way he explains it, he takes us back to the idea of the pianist, the performer. And he basically says that the performance of the pianist is a classic virtuosic activity, because we cannot somehow separate the performance with the work. The two of them are somehow inseparable. And they also, of course, need an audience. This is how this activity can be defined. Going a bit further, he then argues, saying, well, yes, but if this is how it goes, then wouldn't language and communication be the main virtuosic activity nowadays? Now, if we think about this, maybe we would think about things like TEDx nowadays, but this is not, which of course, I mean, some of us like them, some of us don't, but because exactly they present somehow the talent of the speaker. But this is not exactly what Virno would talk about. Virno basically argues that nowadays we're all virtuosos. We're all involved in virtuosic activity. And this is because we all use our linguistic and communicative skills. Taking more to our field, and digital culture, and particularly the networks, my thought was about, so who are the virtuosos today in the networks, and what kind of activities are they involved with? And to go back to the questions that he was framing before, so what is the script that we are performing if we are to compare ourselves with a pianist? And what is the score? What is the measurement, most of all? How our activity can be measured, especially if networks nowadays are the places that we basically all somehow are working while we might be enjoying ourselves. This is a steal from a quote, rather, let's say, from a chat, from an IRC chat back in the 90s. I found it the other day while I was reading a paper, and I found it very interesting because this is something we have completely forgotten about. How things were back then. How users, when involved in a kind of linguistic play, and based on their competencies and skills, they were somehow trying often to impress one another. And the audience, of course, were the other users. Brenda Dunnett, that has written a very nice book, which is called Communication Play, and she exactly examines the role of play back in the 90s. She's calling the users of the 90s like similar to the pianists, and the computer itself as a big piano. So I think this is a very interesting reference, especially if we compare it to this. And I think that this is basically how we see virtuosic activity today. This is an image from Cloud, a social media platform that I guess many of you know, which basically aggregates our scores from the other platforms, our tweets, our shares, our comments, and making a kind of a total amount, it can tell us how influential we are to the others. So what these numbers reflect, at least from my point of view, is kind of the virtuosity of the user behind the content. They reflect how we manage to express, to upload, and to manage moments, actions, and thoughts of our life in proper timing and with a readiness, let's say, for timely interaction. And why is that? I think it's because numbers definitely somehow imply a kind of a game-like condition. They imply that the users are to be seen a bit like players, that they're expected to act and to compete for their online presence and peer recognition. So the question here is, what are the mechanisms that support this new condition of competitiveness? And so this is how we are brought to the idea of gamification. This new kind of strategy that has arrived, that it's a kind of a new process of measurement and self-valorization. Gamification in general is the integration of game mechanics and dynamics in non-game activities. What does this mean? Very simply is that you basically take the game elements and you put them in an activity that is not normally a game. So it's not about games at all. It's more about how you turn health, education, work, advertising, and also the web into a kind of a game-like, gameful experience. And of course, it is based on the idea that in games we are motivated because we do something that we enjoy, that we like. So how about if we take this to other aspects of our life and make them pleasurable as well? And there are several people that have popped up the last few years, and they talk about gamification a lot. One of them is Jane McGonigal, who doesn't like the term gamification, but it's like she's the gamification guru at the same time somehow, because she really believes that with games we can change the world. We will make it better. And she says here that, talking about social networks actually, that the more time we spend interacting within our social networks, the more likely we are to generate a subset of positive emotions. Very interesting. This is from her book, Reality is Broken, that is very, very popular. And, well, I somehow doubt that, just like many other people also do, because if this is so, this would mean that somehow our diffused and gamified virtuosity would actually bring a better world together. But it doesn't look like it's happening for the time being. So to explain this, I will just go through, like have a quick look at what gamification means for the self, for our relationships, and for the urban space. So going back to the cloud score, okay, if we are to judge from this picture, we understand that our online self is formed by data, of course. So it is fed by posts, by likes, by shares, tags, status updates, and it is measured and quantified by sums of numbers. The thing that is interesting, if we think a bit more about it, is that our online self is a bit like an avatar. We do have to feed it every single day, because if we don't do that, it won't be alive somehow. No one will pay attention to it. So we could say that it looks a bit like having a Sims avatar or a Tamagotchi game, because you need to feed it in order to have it. The thing is, however, that it is not really an avatar. It's our online self, and we are dealing here with real data. It is not an imaginary persona. And this complicates things a bit when we give real data. And when we somehow when we start judging the others and ourselves by numbers. Because as Jody Dean has said, we don't anymore somehow pay attention to the duration and to the depth of the commitment. And we are somehow driven in a kind of interpassivity. This is a very nice term of Zizek that you might know. which basically describes the state where one postpones of being effective and being active. Why? Because we leave to our online self somehow the idea that this is the profile has to enjoy, to care, to click, and to somehow show that there is something to change. This is what brought the idea of clicktivism somehow, the phenomenon of clicktivism, to happen. So we put all our energy there, and somehow our real bodily self doesn't really do much. So rather than being active selves that can change the world, as McGonagall argues, it's a question here if we are faced with our lack of real action and a kind of a fetishism of our online selves. Then the question of friendship. Now, our friends are somehow our audience in the social media. If we don't have them, we have no reason to perform, no reason to make our presence obvious. And a lot of scholars have talked about it and have talked about how identity performance is facilitated on the web today. But what is interesting is that we also have to think about how we filter our friends somehow. It is not only about having like big numbers of friends, that of course it's nice to socialize and interact with them, and somehow we all have exceeded the normal numbers since we're in the networks for so many years now. But the question is that for this reason we go into a process of somehow, apart from tagging, untagging, liking and unliking what our friends say, with the social media we have the opportunity to, let's say, select the ones that we want to hear more of, or to block, or to somehow unsubscribe. So what does this mean? This means that social relationships are basically filtered. They are being processed. And on the second level, on a different level, they're also being capitalized. Our friends, of course, have value. And they have value not only because, okay, of course, the social media can make profit out of having more people on the network, but basically because nowadays the companies, as you might have heard of, pay attention to how many friends you have and what kind of friends you have in your network. Do you have like kind of high quality friends that you're connected to? This would somehow enhance job opportunities for you. This is something very interesting that Andrejevitz is talking about. And so somehow the quality and the quantity of friends form the metrics of power for a new social capital. Which is generated by us, which is aggregated by the social networking sites, and it's exploited by third parties. Then the aspect of the gamified city. Now, for people that have worked on games and play, this is like the most interesting contradiction in the case of gamification. We have well-known platforms like Foursquare and Gowalla that I'm sure that you know of, which asks us to wander around in the city or walk around in the city, and wherever we go, we just check in, and we might get badges, and we might become mayors, and we might get free drinks. Anyway, the idea is, of course, that this is connected to the market, and this helps somehow companies and advertisements to make more profit. But where the contradiction is that there was all this beautiful and charming theory back in the 60s of coming from the situationists and Constant. And then they were talking about, Constant was talking about the new Babylon, which was supposed to be the city of movement, the city where citizens would be free, thanks to technology, and they would be liberated, and they would have dynamic relationships with their surroundings. So, and in general, I mean, the situation is that they were talking about psychogeographies and how we follow our own desires, things that are quite well known. The thing is that all this has now been reversed in in a very weird way, because if the situation is we're talking about kind of the Homo Ludens, the man who plays, that would go come after Homo Faber, the man who works, now we're confronting the playful worker, which is like quite a ludic decadence of what is happening. And so to summarize this a lot and not to tire you, how does it work? Well, obviously the idea is that through games, through game-like activities, through competition and through triggering the participants, the networks manage somehow to raise participation and interaction significantly. They manage to have to a new form of wealth, of course, is like that aggregated based on our data that we are giving away. And this data is again open to exploitation and control, to advertising companies, employment networks, or government services. There are a lot of people that can exploit this. And the way it happens, from what I can tell, is that these 4 points. What happens is that it puts our creativity to work, and this is something that happens very easily, because when we are playful, we're somehow not thinking in a way that there is some kind of work involved. So there is a kind of an aspect of ruling through freedom of so like our freedoms and our passions are put to work unconsciously. It somehow undermines human interaction, because we don't think that maybe we don't need all these processes in order to socialize or to go out to the city or to believe in what we have to say in the networks, in our profile. And that's a very interesting other, the third point. It introduces alienation, and with this I mean alienation from our own data. Because when you put too much emphasis on the numbers, then somehow you don't think about the content anymore, or about the person that lies behind the content. And it also facilitates control and exploitation, of course. And that's why a game designer, a well-known game designer, Ian Bogost, has called gamification exploitationware. And so ultimately, we can say that gamification somehow intensifies immaterial labor on the web. And what we are left with is a kind of virtuosic data bodies, kind of data bodies that we basically generate ourselves. But the problem is that although they're based on our competencies and our skills, at the same time, we have no power on them. They belong to the networks. And so where does that leave us, actually? So I think here here's where creativity comes in, or I want to believe that creativity comes in at this point. And to turn again to Virno, there is this beautiful part of an interview of him Virno talks about the dismeasure of art, and he particularly explains how creativity and art can somehow look for new kinds of measurements, because art is disproportional. And in this context, creativity can also introduce new exceptional situations. And with this, he means basically situation and conditions beyond the rules that are being implied. It means a different kind of, a different use of the rules, an unorthodox use of the rules. And we can see quite some examples being proposed by creators, by artists today on the web, but also by users themselves. So I will quickly mention some of them. This is a thing that I'm working on this period, trying to somehow realize and categorize how creators are building different kinds of tactics. So the first one that has to do with faking identities. Okay, this is something that I believe we're more or less all familiar with, how users often pretend to be someone else. But it can go a bit further. Here I have two examples. The one of fakesters, it's a very interesting one, in case you don't know it. It's from Friendster. I think back in 2005, 2006, when was it? Well, there was a period that at Friendster that the network tried to change the rules, and it stopped, it didn't allow any more users to see profiles beyond 4 degrees of separation, which means friends of friends of friends of friends, which is quite a long process, but still this annoyed the users a lot. And what they came up with is that they invented personas, they invented profiles, like Jesus, Madonna, or I don't know what, that worked like hubs, and the users would connect to them, and they would make the bridge and go to the other people that they wanted to go. Which of course, because these people that could be seen as hub had millions of friends in their profile. And then we have many examples also from the Unlike Art Network, which is a part of the Unlike Us network of the Netherlands, that they are building different kinds of application there. John Smith extension is a kind of an add-on that transform users in Facebook and in Google to John Smith, so which is the most common name that you can find in the social media. Another tactic, like overpresence or hypertrophy, I noted here. It's the basic idea of basically drowning the system with data. So if social media care about numbers, how about if you somehow confuse the system completely? And this is from a manifesto, the Facebook Suicide Bomb Manifesto. It's written by Sean Dockery. It's really nice. If you will Google it, you will find it. So as you will see, he says that basically you have to click on as many like buttons as possible, join as many groups as possible, request as many friends as possible. Wherever there is a possibility for action, take it, and take it without any thought whatsoever. Become a machine of for clicking. So somehow you confuse completely the system, which is quite an interesting idea, something that also users, I think, are doing to some extent. Two well-known examples of another tactic come from Liliane Invisible with Seppuku, and also the Web2 suicide machine of Modr, which was basically an application that allowed users to exit networks, to delete their profiles, something that was not allowed in Facebook 2 years, 3 years ago when these projects were born. So it's a kind of freedom, it's a kind of refusal to be in the network. It's a kind of an exit strategy that allow users to basically just go if they wish. And the interesting thing is that they have created a kind of a parody, both projects, so that's why their websites were so nice. And the Seppuku even have a kind of a top suiciders list where you can see like they have created a kind of a different kind of list with the suicides of people and how they are happy and how they did it. And then another example comes from Tobias Lengruber and the Fat Lab that you might also have heard of. Tactics more of appropriation. Toby, the last few years, is running Facebook resistance workshops, and he's working with young people that are interested to basically create kind of counter tools, tools that might be like dislike buttons or applications like that, that he says, what are you worth to Facebook? So somehow he invites people to realize how these mechanisms work and to introduce new ones that are basically humorous, but they also work, which is interesting. And this is a very nice project that he initiated, I think, last year, the Social ID Bureau, as it was called. And what he basically did was that he set up an office in a space, and he was inviting people to come and print the Facebook identity cards. And and of course, if we think about it, this card has more data about us than our real ID has. Of course, this drove Facebook crazy. They sent him a cease and desist letter, and they threatened him with a legal prosecution. And then Toby just basically took down the web page and stopped the project. But it was already somehow too late, because the idea was that anyway this somehow spread like a virus. More artists started being involved in this process, and I think there is even another artist doing a similar project now on Google Plus. What else? Yeah. To a different direction, Tactics of Exposure. This is a project by a collective from Athens, Personal Cinema. It's called Folded In. It's a very interesting project because it has studied the way YouTube works. It has studied the game mechanics YouTube uses, and how it somehow embraces the participation of users through competition, and how people in YouTube compete based on their national stereotypes or other kind of stereotypes, and why that's why it's about a lot about the idea of a YouTube video war. And a more recent example, because the previous project was from 2008, the Cowclicker of Ian Bogost, a wonderful story about behind this project, if you don't know it. Ian decided that he would somehow make fun of clicktivism and Farmville, and he designed a cow, which is very much like the Farmville one. And he put it on Facebook like an application, and he said to people, okay, you have to click it, but you have to click it every 6 hours, otherwise you lose, it doesn't work. And the funny thing is that people, of course, got involved in this and started clicking every 6 hours. And the cows went viral. Everybody loved it for some reason, so it got a kind of a weird acceptance, let's say. And Ian took this further by somehow producing t-shirts and cups and everything with his cows. And and I think just to sum up, I would like to say that, more or less I tried to describe a bit what gamification is and what it works, how it works. And I do believe that it's a kind of a strategy that intensifies relationships and interactions, aiming to generate value. But at the same time, it underestimates the possibilities for critical resistance against its game-like structures. And it underestimates the counterpower tactics that are being developed by, or can be developed by users, programmers, or artists. And somehow these tactics, like the ones I presented as examples, are in a way kinds of acts of disobedience and exit. And somehow they might be allusions to what kind of the digital, the virtuosity of the digital multitude could be, but at the same time it has to do with the users themselves. So somehow I think it's up to us to decide if we prefer to play in gamified networks, or if we can turn towards exceptional situations and topologies that might subvert the network and somehow set our virtuosity free. That's all. Thanks.